Our opening words this morning are written by William Ellery Channing, and the title of this reading is The Great End in Religious Education. Religious Instruction. The great end in religious instruction is not to stamp our minds upon the young, but to stir up their own. Not to make them see with our eyes, but to look inquiringly and steadily with their own. Not to give them a definite amount of knowledge, but to inspire a fervent love of truth. Not to form outward regularity, but to touch inward springs. Not to bind them by ineradicable prejudices to our own particular sect or peculiar notions, but to prepare them for impartial, conscientious judging of whatever subjects may be offered to their decision. Not to burden the memory, but to quicken and strengthen the power of thought. Not to impose religion upon them in the form of arbitrary rules, but to awaken the conscience, the moral discernment. In a word, the great end is to awaken the soul, to excite and cherish spiritual life. And so we come to the time in our service when we have some moments to take a deep breath, maybe the first deep breath we've had a chance to take in a while, to find ourselves in the midst of beloved community, a time to find some peace inside for prayer and meditation. And today I offer you some words, then some silence, and then some music for lighting candles. The meditation comes from the writings of one of your former ministers and one of my former ministers and my friend, George Kim Beach. May the wonder of being at one with any other single soul be upon us and quiet our anxious hearts. May the miracle of being more than only useful to one another, of bearing the gifts of goodness and strength to one another, be upon us and quiet our anxious hearts. May the recognition of others' needs, so different from our own, enlarge our vision of the spiritual community we share. May compassion be upon us and quiet our anxious hearts. May the awakening of conscience be upon us and raise up courage we did not know we had and quiet our anxious hearts. May the love of life well up within us and the blessed gifts of this day be upon us and quiet our anxious hearts. May holy persuasion reconcile us and joy overcome our anxious hearts. Let us follow the tone into the silence. Some beliefs are like walled gardens. They encourage exclusiveness and the feeling of being excessively privileged. Other beliefs are expansive and lead the way into wider and deeper sympathies. Some beliefs are like shadows, clouding children's days with fears of unknown calamities. Other beliefs are like sunshine, blessing children with the warmth of happiness. Some beliefs are divisive, separating the saved from the unsaved, friends from enemies. Other beliefs are bonds in a world community where sincere differences beautify the pattern. Some beliefs are like blinders, shutting off the power to choose one's own direction. Other beliefs are like gateways, opening wide vistas for exploration. Some beliefs welcome a person's selfhood. They blight the growth of resourcefulness. Other beliefs nurture self-confidence and enrich the feeling of personal worth. Some beliefs are rigid, like the body of death, impotent in a changing world. Other beliefs are pliable, like the young sapling, ever growing with the upward thrust of life. And that was by Sophia Lyon Foss. For so the children come, and so they have been coming, always in the same way they come, born of the seed of man and woman. No angels herald their beginnings, no prophets predict their future courses, no wise men see a star to show where to find the babe that will save humankind. Yet each night a child is born is a holy night. Fathers and mothers sitting beside their children's cribs feel glory in the sight of a new life beginning. They ask, where and how will this new life end, or will it ever end? Each night a child is born is a holy night, a time for singing, a time for wondering, a time for worshiping. Well, undoubtedly at this moment you are wondering, where's Laura? She is the preacher today, so what happened? Well, this is what happened. I had a message that I on the voicemail here at church, and I picked it up about 9:25, I think it was, and it was Laura, and she said, "Not to worry, but I've been in a car accident. I'm okay. I'm not in the hospital. My neck and my shoulder really hurt a lot, but I am not going to be able to get to church today, and I have left some things for the sermon in your box, so would you be so kind?" And relieved as I am to know that she isn't in the hospital, she sounded very shaken up and very much in shock. And I, of course, called or asked other people to call and find out more. And what we found out is that she's at home, she's resting, she's in some pain. You know, her shoulder's been bothering her for a long time, so this is not good. But what she left for me is two things, two versions. I think two versions of the same service, the same sermon. And the first service got the first version. I kind of went from place to place in this particular edition, and so I decided to try doing the second version for the second service. And so I'm going to intermingle a couple of things, but in the meantime, this is what I can do for you. This is part of my job. So I hope that those of you who hadn't ever heard of Sophia Lyon Foss will have a better appreciation of her and what she has done for us. I've always called her the mother of religious liberal education, or liberal religious education. Now, okay, this is version two. The life of Sophia Lyon Foss was a remarkable journey from the heart of evangelical Christian orthodoxy to a leadership role in a revitalized religious liberalism, a revitalization due in large part to her role as an innovative religious educator. Born in China in 1876, the child of Presbyterian missionaries, Sophia Lyon graduated from Worcester College in Worcester, Ohio, dedicated to a career in the student volunteer movement, for which she had signed a pledge card reading, quote, "It is my purpose in life if God permit, to become a foreign missionary. End quote. The goal of this movement was the, quote, evangelization of the world in this generation, a period roughly between 1880 and 1905. Well, that goal was not realized. Following graduation from high school and 2 years teaching high school Latin, she spent the next 2 years as a student volunteer visiting colleges and seeking to convince students to sign the pledge that she herself had signed. Then, in 1901, Sophia took a part-time job as YWCA secretary at the University of Chicago. She planned to take courses while there, feeling the need for further education to prepare herself adequately for the mission field. Her older sister and her future husband were already involved, enrolled at the university. Sophia had been warned of its radical intellectual atmosphere, but she confidently wrote to her sister, "Many skeptics are sent out from there who were formerly professing Christians. They, however, had not found, I believe, the real fundamental Christian life." End quote. Sure of her own faith, but also armed with a curious and able mind, Sophia began her studies in Chicago. President of the university at that time was William Rainey Harper, known as the food court there, champion of the higher criticism of the Bible, a study that takes into consideration the historic context within which the books of the Bible were written. In other words, biblical criticism isn't just saying, I don't like this, and I don't like that, and I don't like the way this goes. It's a scientific study which had a profound effect on the churches at the beginning of the 20th century and resulted in the modernist movement, which would come to a head with Christian fundamentalism in 1925 at the Scopes trial. Remember, anybody who's seen Inherit the Wind knows about the Scopes monkey trial. Also teaching at the university was John Dewey, one of the fathers of the progressive education movement. Harper and Dewey symbolized the influences that would lead Sophia Lyon over a period of years to rethink the theology that underlay the real fundamental Christian life of which she had been so sure. And certainly, when I took an education course during the summer at the university, it was marvelous, really built on constructs that Dewey had brought there. In June of 1902, she married fellow student volunteer Charles Harvey Foss. Because of his health problems, the young couple could not go immediately into the mission field, but instead moved to New York City, where Mr. Foss accepted a position with the National Board of Missions of the Methodist Church. Sophia continued her studies, now at Columbia University's Teachers College, another intellectually exciting place, where John Dewey would then join the faculty in 1904. Maybe he was following her, I don't know. In addition to the influence of a higher criticism of the Bible and the humanistic concepts of progressive education on the thinking of Sophia Foss was the influence of her own children. Between 1905 and 1914, five children were born to Sophia and her husband. And as she later wrote, "The children who joined our family circle were not merely the object of my educational efforts. They were the most potent source of my own education." In a vital sense, the children were unwittingly my major teachers. Since her husband's health continued to be a problem, all thought of going out as foreign missionaries was abandoned. Now, Harvey Foss had found his niche in writing and working with world missionary leaders, work that frequently took him out of the country. Sophia Foss joined the Methodist Church so that she and her husband would be members of the same denomination, and they lived in New York City for the rest of their lives, married lives. along with her studies under men at the forefront of the progressive educational movement at Teachers College, Sophia had the opportunity to observe teachers at the Horace Mann School, which was the lab school of the college, that is Columbia. She was deeply impressed. But how to translate what she was learning and observing into her chosen field of religious education? One of her teachers, Frank McMurray, showed her how to take the first steps in that direction. He emphasized the primacy of experience in the education of children and the importance of vivid, accurate detail in materials written for them. He believed that Bible stories did not meet these criteria, but material about the lives and work of present-day missionaries who were motivated by the Bible did. Excited by this whole concept, she wrote her first book, Uganda's White Man of Work, which was published by the Missionary Education Movement in 1907. Written for young people, the book described an industrial missionary in Uganda and brought in biblical material as it played a role in the missionary's life and work. The book was very successful. It was kept in print until 1947, sold more than 50,000 copies. The author would herself, however, by the time it was published, would have chosen a very different path in her thinking and writing for the religious education of children. Now, during this time, Sophia was bearing children, coping with their illnesses, and actually with the death of two of them. She also took course in writing. She lectured at religious education conferences. She taught Sunday school classes in this experimental Sunday school run by Teachers College. She taught church school leaders. She wrote numerous articles. Now, as she hammered out her increasingly liberal theology and its implications for religious education, she found herself drawing less exclusively on the Bible, on the Judeo-Christian tradition, and more on natural sciences and on religions of other people, on world religions. She had discovered that ancient peoples developed their religious ideas as they reacted to the natural world around them. What if today's children were allowed to express freely their reactions to the same primary phenomena, birth and death, sun, moon and stars, dreams, shadows, wind and rain? Should not children's inescapable confrontations with and reflection on these realities be the beginning of their religious education rather than Bible stories about people long ago and far away, which is the title of one of the books that was written with her work? Not only did she delay children's exposure to the Bible until they were ready for history generally, but she was even suggesting that children not be introduced to other people's ideas of God until they had an opportunity to begin developing their own. Well, she was experimenting with experience-centered religious education. And she did this wherever she could, in any church that would have her. But she was thwarted by the unreadiness of most ministers to embrace her ideas. So she felt the need for a systematic study of theology herself. And in 1923, she enrolled as a student at nearby Union Theological Seminary, where the Bible was being taught from the modernist point of view that she now so heartily embraced. She was soon a teacher at the Union School of Religion in Teachers College. She found, however, that she was frequently in direct conflict with the other members of the faculty. They claimed to be modernist, but they were still basically orthodox, and other orthodoxies were preparing to move in. At this time, the Riverside Church was being built across the street from Union Seminary, and it was built expressly, specifically to provide a pulpit for Henry Emerson Fosdick, the champion of modernism. Now, its Sunday school was supposed to be experimental, and she had been invited to try out some of her ideas there at Riverside. And her work there was the core of the Unitarian curriculum that she developed between 1937 and 1965. She wrote an article called "How Childish Should a Child's Religion Be?" And it was commented on favorably by the editor of the Unitarian Christian Register. It was important to realize that in this day, both of those religions that we count as our own, the Universalist and the Unitarian, were specifically Christian religions. And so the Christian Register was where everybody looked for the reviews of the various books that were coming out. She was eventually the editor of children's materials for the American Unitarian Association, because for more than 30 years she had been wrestling with her ideas about how to bring experiential material to children's education. And during her work in education, she came upon, of course, William Ellery Channing, who said, "It's not our job to stamp our minds on the minds of the young, but to stir their own minds so that they might so that they might think for themselves." Most Unitarians would not permit this modernist and liberal point of view, but there were some exceptions. There was a minister who wrote a book called Beginnings, which was sociology of religion, and he wrote, "All life is religious. All nature is religious. Our own pond lilies are just as religious as the lilies of the field of which Jesus spoke." And another Unitarian minister said that we needed a whole curriculum based on the experiential nature, and he called this the Beacon Series. And some of you who have been around for quite a while in UU circles might have seen other books that were developed in the Beacon Series. This one, which that Laura left for me in my mailbox, is called Martin and Judy. And if there are any lifelong Unitarians here, now Unitarian Universalists, who might have been through Sunday school, let's see, you'd have to be well on in years. I'm not going to say anymore. This was published in 1948. Hey, you could have had this. I could have had this, except they didn't have it on my denomination. But this could have been part of your curriculum for your school, for your religious education. So, along with Martin and Judy, there were books called The Family Finds Out, The Tuckers, Growing Bigger, A Brand New Baby, and Animal Babies. Sounds like fun for our kids. Oh, the one I particularly wanted to mention to you is the one called The Church Across the Street. Now, we know it nowadays as Our Neighboring Faiths, and our middle schoolers are lucky in that they are participating in Our Neighboring Faith, which gives young people a wonderful opportunity to visit other faiths' homes of worship and gives them an opportunity to develop their own thinking about that particular faith and compare it with their own Unitarian Universalist faith. I'm skipping a whole bunch of this, and I will now go to the other portion of the... Okay, one more thing, and then I'll go to the other portion of version one. In February of 1959, at age 82, Sophia Foss accepted the invitation of a new church, then called the Montgomery County Unitarian Church of Bethesda, Maryland, which I think today may be Cedar, I'm not sure which one it is. It might be River Road. I'm not sure. to be ordained into the Unitarian ministry. It was a booming church with the largest church school in the country. Well, she gave her own ordination sermon, and she shared her dreams about how these wonderful experiential ways could be brought into the religious education in all congregations. When she died at the age of 101 in 1978, her reforms had not taken place. Neither have they taken place since her death. With the exception of From Long Ago and Many Lands and her book Old Tales for a New Day, this author says, I think I'm correct in saying that all of the other titles in the New Beacon series are out of print. That is expected of materials that embrace the philosophy that new occasions teach new duties, time makes ancient good uncouth, they may upward, still and onward, who would keep abreast of truth. Now I want to read you what I consider one of the best parts of her life story, and it happens to be an interesting little vignette from her life. It's titled, Where is the Me? Sophia Lyon Foss was stimulated to take a path that led her to become one of the great innovative liberal religious educators of the 20th century by a sudden question by her 7.5-year-old daughter, Ruth, in 1914. Mother, where is the me? It seems to be always my hand, my foot, my head, or my skin, but where is the me? It was a profound question. Files had studied an open approach to the questioning child in religion, but her studies had not prepared her to answer her daughter's question. She appreciated her daughter's dilemma. Your leg cannot think, can it? She asked Ruth. No, said Ruth, it is my brain that thinks. But where is the me? Your brain cannot love, said her mother. No, said Ruth, but it is my heart that loves. Where is the me? We speak of the heart as loving, said Mrs. Foss. Actually, but it is really not the heart. It is only the me that can love and be kind. But where is the me? Said Ruth. I don't know, said her mother. I only know that we each have a me. Sophia Lyon Foss did not have an answer, and perhaps the question could not be adequately answered. 4 years later, in 1918, Ruth burst out with the same question again, Where is the me? Both had remembered the question from years before, and Ruth was still searching for an answer. Soon she recited to her mother a poem composed in her mind. And this is where I'd like to end our sermon for today, because I think this is just right. She composed this in her mind. Where is the really, really me? I'm somewhere, I know, but where can that be? I am not my nose, nor my mouth, nor my eye. I am not my feet, nor my legs, nor my thigh. I'm not my hand, not my arm, not my hip. And I'm not my teeth, nor my tongue, nor my lip. I'm sure I'm not my elbow or my knee. Oh, where am I? Oh, where can I be? Perhaps a thoughtful response to some of the most penetrating questions in religion is, I don't know. And this wondering and pondering approach to religious education became the basis for Sophia Lyon Foss' seminal series of books on religious education, and makes her the mother of modern religious education. Well, that was version two. There might be a version three around here someplace, but Laura didn't give it to me. I just, I was able to sight read just a tiny bit of that beforehand. So there we are. You know everything you needed to know about religious education then and now.